Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Ten Commandments in American law right after this. You know, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small, and you shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight, and a perfect and a just measure shall you have." Well, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 followed that scriptural principle of law when they put into our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10, these 17 words. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." But back in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation, and now, in place of these just weights and balances, these two presidents have introduced our current practice of the first, second, and fifth planks of the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system, and they've given us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coins. And now, in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we're the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our nation, Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons in our Mosaic Law School conducted twice a year here at the Law School in Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package first. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. And it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? All right, the Ten Commandments in American law. You know, Matthew D. Staver is the founder of the Liberty Council in Orlando, Florida. It's a nonprofit legal organization which defends First Amendment cases across America. Well, in February of 2001, Staver asked me to serve as an expert witness in several United States District Court cases regarding a prepared list of historical documents which influenced America's founding and approved to be used in public venues. And this list included colonial documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. It also included the Ten Commandments. That's the opening statement in a book called The Ten Commandments and Their Influence on American Law. It's written by William J. Federer. William J. Federer. It's not George Gordon that did this. I just wanted to report as a reporter that the Ten Commandments in American law go long, and their roots are deep in our system of jurisprudence. In fact, they go back to Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai, remember, is the place where the Ten Commandments, which is commonly called the Decalogue, was first given. And from that point forward in an Anglo-Saxon administration, we've been using these principles of law and time and time again, I've mentioned that in our Constitution, the United States Constitution, there are 22 principles of the Ten Commandment Law inscribed in our federal Constitution. But you know, that's not the only place that we find it. For instance, all 13 of the original colonies adopted the Ten Commandments as the fundamental law of the colonies. Well, all but one, Rhode Island. And in Rhode Island, they did not adopt all 10 of the Ten Commandments. They only adopted 6. The other 12 colonies adopted all 10 of the Ten Commandments, and Rhode Island adopted 6 of the Ten Commandments as the fundamental law of the colonies. Now, today in America, we have banished the Ten Commandments. I mean, if you were to bring up the Ten Commandments in public school or in a college or university, or you brought it up in Congress or the president mentioned that way, the ACLU would be on them like flies on stink. And in fact, there's a couple, three cases in here where the ACLU hasn't succeeded. I mean, they're pretty successful most of the time in stamping the Bible and God and prayer and everything else out of American life. They haven't succeeded every time, but most of the time they do. And so today, if you're a young person, say you're under 40, you probably have had an education here which is totally devoid of any concept of the Ten Commandments, prayer, or the Bible in your life, especially public life or school life. I mean, it's just devoid. It's gone. It's a blank space. Now, you're not short of education. You have plenty of education. Somebody's funneled a lot of information into your brain, but they didn't funnel that information into your brain. Is there something important about the Ten Commandments that should be in everybody's brain that would make things different in the world, in your state, in your community, in your country? And the answer to that is absolutely. And every one of our presidents has said so. The Congress has said so repeatedly. Not recently, but repeatedly. All of our state legislatures have. And most of our most famous public figures have placed great value on the Ten Commandments in public life, the Ten Commandments and their influence in American law, and on American society. And this isn't just true in America, it's true in Anglo-Saxon administration around the world. Now, the ACLU objected to the Ten Commandments being included in the list. Matthew Staver began preparations to take these cases to the Supreme Court, if necessary. And the book that you're about to read contains the expert witness testimony that I prepared as a primary exhibit, along with the legal commentary by Matthew D. Staver. Admittedly, this book is a collection of evidence rather than a typical book for entertainment. And this information was also provided to the attorneys for Grand Junction, Colorado, who were successful in defending a similar monument. Others involved in the legal effort to preserve the historical truth of America's founding, including J. Allen Sukolo and Alabama Supreme Court Roy Moore, among many others. This information is presented not as a public policy recommendation, but rather as documentation that the historical record is replete with evidence that the Ten Commandments have directly and indirectly influenced America's founders, America's leaders, and America's system of government and legal code. And therefore, they deserve to be included among the publicly acknowledged historical documents which have impacted the founding of America. Now, in Lexington, Kentucky, handling the ACLU a significant defeat, Federal District Court Judge Carl Forrester in the Eastern District of Columbia held on Wednesday that a display of the Ten Commandments, together with other historical documents in Mercer County, Kentucky, is constitutional. Mercer County is represented jointly by Liberty Counsel and the American Center for Law and Justice. Now, the ACLU sued Mercer County for its display in the county courthouse that contained the Ten Commandments, The display included the Ten Commandments, the Mayflower Compact, the Declaration of Independence, the Magna Carta, the Star-Spangled Banner, the national motto, the preamble to the Kentucky Constitution, the Bill of Rights to the United States Constitution, and a picture of Lady Justice. It named the foundations of American law and government. The display is intended to depict several documents that have played a significant role in the founding of our system of law and our system of government. Well, Judge Forrester had previously denied the ACLU's request for an injunction against the display, and in a previous opinion denying the request for an injunction, Forrester stated that for good or bad, right or wrong, the Ten Commandments did have an influence upon the development of United States law, and it can be constitutional to display the Ten Commandments in the appropriate context. Judge Forrester's decision Wednesday that ended the ACLU's challenge against Mercer County recognized that the display clearly has a legitimate secular purpose of including but not limited to acknowledging the historical influence of the Ten Commandments on the development of this country's laws, and this record is devoid of any evidence indicating a religious purpose by the government. So based upon this, Judge Forrester granted the county's motion for summary judgment and issued a final judgment holding that the display is constitutional. Now, Matt Staver hailed today's decision as a great victory, and Staver said, "Today's decision begins to turn the tide against the ACLU, which has been on a search-and-destroy mission to remove all vestiges of our religious history from public view." And Staver added that whether the ACLU likes it or not, history is crystal clear that each and every one of the Ten Commandments has played an important role in the founding of our system of law and government. And each one of the Ten Commandments was adopted as law by 12 of the 13 original American colonies. And Staver also added that as long as a government entity displays the Ten Commandments together with historical documents and does so for an educational or historical purpose, such displays will be constitutional. And Staver concluded that this case should be used as a model for other counties and cities and states wishing to display historical documents, including the Ten Commandments, and those displays are constitutional. So, the Ten Commandments, then, on October 11, 2002, were ruled to be constitutional in a federal judge in Texas, the Capitol Exhibit Constitutional by John Doherty. That was reported on WorldNetDaily.com in 2002. A federal judge in Austin, Texas, has ruled that a 42-year-old display of the Ten Commandments on the grounds of the state capitol building is not an official endorsement of religion, and it can remain intact. U.S. District Judge Harry Lee Hudspeth found that the 6-foot by 3-foot granite memorial, one of 17 monuments on state capitol grounds, was appropriate as a tool to promote youth morality and to stop the alarming increase in delinquency, and they served a legitimate secular purpose. The court also found that no reasonable observer would conclude that the state sought to advance or endorse religion. The Ten Commandments display did not contain the seal of the state, as other monuments do, and the court was clear in noting that the display of the monument could not be interpreted by any reasonable observer as a state endorsement of religion. And so said Matthew Staver. He's the president and general counsel of Liberty Counsel, a nonprofit legal group that defends religious freedom cases. Now, each of the Ten Commandments has played a significant role in the foundation of our system of law and government, he said, adding that the biblical edicts have both a secular as well as a religious aspect. Now, Liberty Counsel filed an amicus brief with the court in support of the state of Texas, Thomas Van Orden, a criminal defense lawyer, who has temporarily lost his law license and is now homeless, filed suit to have the display removed, claiming that it was an official endorsement of religion. He could not be reached for comment. And a quotation, "To ignore the influence of the Ten Commandments in the founding and shaping of American law and government would require significant historical revisionism," Staver told WorldNetDaily.com. And he said, "They take on an even greater secular aspect when placed in the context of other historical or legal documents, such as in the context of the state capitol." Texas Governor Rick Perry also applauded the ruling. "Today's court ruling is a victory for those who believe, as I do, that the Ten Commandments are time-tested and appropriate guidelines for living a full and moral life." And he said in a statement, "The Ten Commandments provide a historical foundation for our laws and principles as a free and strong nation under God and should be displayed at the Texas Capitol." Staver said that he was unsure whether Van Orden would appeal. The display was donated to the state by the Fraternal Order of Eagles in 1961 as part of a youth guidance project to give the youth of the nation a code of conduct by which to govern their actions, said Staver. The monument sits in a small park-like subsection between the state Supreme Court building and the Capitol building. Display of the Ten Commandments has not fared well recently in other court venues. On Wednesday, a federal court in Frankfort, Kentucky, rejected a plan to display a Ten Commandments monument near the state capitol, saying it was a thinly disguised effort at government promotion of religion. However, the court said the state could display the edicts by presenting them in the context of other historical and non-religious material. In 1997, then-Alabama State Court Judge, Supreme Court Judge Roy Moore, over the objections of the American Civil Liberties Union, posted the Ten Commandments in his chambers. Moore then was elevated to the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court and then later removed. If you'd like to view the article online, it's got a section here on the online portion. Now, here's the point that we want to make. The Ten Commandments have been ruled to be constitutional in the context of a secular display of other important historical documents. So, you know, if you're a county commissioner out there somewhere, and you've heard about the Ten Commandments and Judge Roy Moore and others, and you say, well, I guess we better not do that here in our county, take heart, because the U.S. Supreme Court gave the guidelines some years back, and they said, listen, it isn't that these religious comments or statements or the Ten Commandments or the Decalogue or something else is of and by itself wrong. If it's appropriately put to a secular use, and they emphasize the word secular use. You see, most people would ascribe the Ten Commandments to a religious use and say, well, you know, the Ten Commandments come from the Bible, and the Bible is religious, and so therefore is promotion of religion. That's the ACLU position, that anything that comes out of the Bible would be religious. Well, one-third of the Bible is history. One-third of the entire Scripture now is history. Doesn't have much to do with thou shalt not steal, or, you know, you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag or something like that. So the Ten Commandments then, when they're displayed with the Constitution or the Bill of Rights or the Declaration of Independence or something else then, are a part of a historical display, and they ought to be included because the Ten Commandments are probably more historically relevant than the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, or the Declaration of Independence, probably. Now, this book is about 200 pages. Let me just look back here. That's 263 pages to there. Let's see, 279.85. That's pushing 300 pages, 287 pages. And then it's called The Ten Commandments and Their Influence on American Law. Can't cover all 287 pages, but I can cover a few pages for you and demonstrate that there is more in American law that is directly attributable to the Ten Commandments than to any other historical person or any other historical document in our history. Let me repeat that. You will find more from the Ten Commandments in the laws of the United States than you will from any historical document or any other historical person. And then there's a little story in here that I'll cover a little later on, and I'll show you how that comes to pass. The Ten Commandments are very important in American law. In fact, they're very important in French law, English law, German law, Icelandic law, Canadian, Australian. You know, all of you people have a history that dates back to the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai. And whether you like to admit it or not, there's a whole lot more about your judicial systems and your laws and rules and regulations. For instance, the concept of thou shalt do no murder comes from thou shalt not kill, one of the Ten Commandments. If you have laws in your country that prohibit rape, did you know that comes from the Ten Commandments and thou shalt not commit adultery? You see, adultery has a larger meaning. It's more all-encompassing than just going out here and gangbanging or working on your neighbor's wife. That's a part of it. There's no doubt about that. But sex crimes in general, or sexual molestation of children and so on, you know that comes from the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not commit adultery, and Leviticus chapter 18, thou shalt not steal. All of your theft laws are predicated upon that one commandment. Four words, thou shalt not steal, sums it up pretty well. And it covers things like stealing people's cars and lawnmowers and fraud and securities violations and so on. Theft is theft is theft is theft, but it occurs in a number of ways. So when God said, thou shalt not steal, he summed it up in a flare, or with a flare, and he said, don't steal. Now, of course, there's as many ways to steal as there are people to dream them up. And so states then come along and codify governments, like France or Germany. And they codify the various modalities of theft, maybe in their Securities and Exchange Commission, or maybe in their treasury rules and regulations. But nevertheless, the fundamentals of law come from the Ten Commandments. Where'd you get the idea that people ought not to steal, they ought not to kill other people, or that they shouldn't practice sexual predator crimes against people? Come from the Ten Commandments. And so through the years, while we don't ascribe, you know, thou shalt not steal automobiles to the Ten Commandments in our secular law, that's indeed where it came from. That's where the principle of conduct came from. Now, in his commentary, The Ten Commandments in American Law and Government, Matthew Staver writes, when a governmental practice has been deeply embedded in the history and tradition of this country, such a practice will not violate the Establishment Clause because the practice has become part of the fabric of our society. It comes from Marsh versus Chambers, 463 U.S. 783, back in 1983. The Ten Commandments played a significant role in the development of American law. The incorporation of the Ten Commandments in law and policy predates the Constitution. And this intermingling of the Ten Commandments into American law and government was long before the appearance of legislative prayers. The drafters of the First Amendment would never have dreamed that they were abolishing the Decalogue. From time out of mind, courts, legislatures, and our founding fathers have referred to the Ten Commandments and their impact upon our culture, their impact upon our legal system. The Supreme Court has often recognized the impact that the Ten Commandments has played on our system of law and government. And you'll see that in Griswold versus Connecticut back in 1965. Now, in McGowan versus Maryland, Justice Frankfurter said that immutable civil regulations enforce conduct which harmonizes with religious canons. State prohibitions of murder, theft, and adultery reinforce commands from the Decalogue. In Stone versus Graham, we read, it is equally undeniable that the Ten Commandments have had a significant impact on the development of secular legal codes of the Western world. And in Lynch versus Donnelly, describing the depiction of Moses with the Ten Commandments on the wall of the Supreme Court chamber, and stating that such acknowledgments of religion demonstrate that our history is pervaded by expressions of religious belief. I don't know if you knew this or not, but on both the interior and exterior of the Supreme Court building, you have the full face profile, or the full face figure of Moses holding the Ten Commandments in the Supreme Court of the United States. In Edwards versus Aguillard, acknowledging that the Ten Commandments did not play an exclusively religious role in the history of Western civilization, the Ten Commandments have been repeatedly used by government from the conception of America. Each of the Ten Commandments has played some significant role in the foundation of our legal system and our system of law and government. 12 of the 13 original colonies adopted the entire Decalogue into their civil and criminal laws. Joseph Story, the eminent Supreme Court justice, who was the youngest justice ever appointed and who served on the Supreme Court for 34 years, from 1811 to 1845, remarked, "Now, there will probably be found few persons in this or any other Christian country who would deliberately contend that it was unreasonable or unjust to foster and encourage the Christian religion generally as a matter of sound policy, as well as of revealed truth. In fact, every American colony from its foundation down to the Revolution, with the exception of Rhode Island, if indeed that state can be an exception, did openly, by the whole course of its laws and institutions, support and sustain in some form the Christian religion, and almost invariably gave a peculiar sanction to some of its fundamental doctrines. And this has continued to be the case in some of the states down to the present period, without the slightest suspicion that it was against the principles of public law or republican liberty." Joseph Story, Three Commentaries on the Constitution of the United States, published in 1867. Now, Rhode Island adopted the last six of the commandments, but not the first four. See Alvin W. Johnson's Sunday Legislation. And so, Rhode Island is in there. The only exception is that they did not, of the 13 original colonies, they did not adopt the first four commandments of the Ten Commandments into their secular law in Rhode Island. Everybody else did. And Rhode Island wasn't opposed to the Ten Commandments. They, for some reason, didn't adopt those four. Now, showing the influence that the Ten Commandments have had on American law is akin to the task of showing their immense influence in Western culture. The references listed in this book are just a small sampling of the thousands of supporting citations available in the historical record. Now, the Ten Commandments were referred to directly by America's founders and leaders as the laws of God, ordinances of God, statutes of God, divine law, revealed law, holy law, book of laws, eternal laws, laws given to Moses on the Mount, his just and holy laws, the Decalogue, foundation of our holy religion, immutable laws of good and evil, government of God, and so on. Now, the Ten Commandments were referred to indirectly in statements made in the context of religion, virtue, principles, and morals. And in his commentary, The Ten Commandments in American Law and Government, Matthew D. Staver writes that in 1950, the Supreme Court of Florida declared, quote, "A people unschooled about the sovereignty of God, the Ten Commandments, and the ethics of Jesus could never have evolved the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitution. There is not one solitary fundamental principle of our democratic policy that did not stem directly from the basic moral concepts embodied in the Decalogue. 1950, the Supreme Court of Florida said that. And they said it in a case called Florida versus City of Tampa, 1950. Now, to see the original Constitution and Declaration of Independence, one must first view the Ten Commandments at the entrance to the National Archives. And when you go into the entrance to the National Archives, you will view the Ten Commandments. Moses is the only figure facing forward out of 23 other profiles of famous lawgivers, and he occupies the central position in the United States House of Representatives in the chamber. And similarly, Moses with the Ten Commandments faces forward in the central position perched over the Chief Justice's seat in the United States Supreme Court. See Lynch versus Donnelly at 465 U.S. 668. The Ten Commandments in the new displays was only one frame among many other secular, historical, and legal documents. The Ten Commandments by no means dominated the display. Viewed in its entirety, one may not conclude that the Ten Commandments is an establishment of religion. The Decalogue played a significant role in the formation and the foundation of American law. Any other conclusion would require erasing numerous pages of American history. So let's take a look at the influence of the commandments by William J. Federer right after this. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk in the law. Our website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Now, once again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. Now, we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements and recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing or recommending will necessarily reciprocate. That's all. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the Ten Commandments in American Law. It's a book written by William J. Federer. Let's see if we can get you a publisher here and an ISBN number. It was copyrighted by William J. Federer, spelled F-E-D-E-R-E-R. I'm sure you can get a copy of it from Barnes & Noble or from your local bookstore. Copyright 2003. No prior permission is necessary to reproduce 5,000 words or less, provided acknowledgement is given to the Ten Commandments and their influence on American law, study, and history by William J. Federer. Okay, we're going to do that, Bill. Let's see where you can get a copy of this. It's called AmeriSearch Incorporated, P.O. Box 20163, St. Louis, Missouri. Zip code is 63123. They got a phone number there. It's 1-888-USA-WORD. Once more, that's 314-487-4395. Well, I guess that's their voice or fax number. Well, see, it's both. So you got two numbers here. It's 1-888-USA-WORD. I don't know what that number represents, but get that down. 1-888, it's toll-free, USA-WORD. That's called AmeriSearch, AmeriSearch Incorporated, P.O. Box 20163, St. Louis. Or online, it's www.amerisearch.net. How's that? www.amerisearch, AmeriSearch.net. I'm sure you can get a copy of the book from that source. Probably Barnes & Noble have it. This is not a religious book, per se. You might find it in a Christian bookstore, maybe. But it's a secular book. It's not they're not trying to promote Christianity or Muslim theology or anything like that. It's a legal book, legal text. We use books like this here at the law school, and that's because years ago we recognized that the Ten Commandments and the Bible are the founding pillars. They're the foundation of American jurisprudence, American or Anglo-Saxon administration. And so we teach it from that point of view. We teach law here from the point of view of the Bible. I know it sounds kind of crazy, but they used to do that at Harvard until 1942. If you were an incoming freshman until the year 1942, you would have been started on two fundamental books. Two fundamental. Let's start you off with Blackstone's Commentaries and the Book of Hebrews in the Bible. That biblical book in the New Testament called Hebrews, up until 1942. Then Harvard, they joined the anti-God, anti-Bible crusade. All right, the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount contain my religion. And so wrote John Adams to Thomas Jefferson on November the 4th, 1816. John Adams, second president of the United States. He said the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount contain my religion. This admission by Adams is very significant, as he was a key founder. He was a graduate of Harvard. Adams was an original member of the Continental Congress, and he was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. Adams recommended that Thomas Jefferson pen the Declaration and that George Washington be the Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army. John Adams helped write the Massachusetts Constitution. He was the first U.S. Vice President, serving under Washington for 8 years, and he was the second U.S. President. He was the first president to reside in the White House, and it was under his administration that the Department of the Navy and the Library of Congress were established. He was the husband of Abigail Adams, whose letters are considered among the best accounts of the Revolutionary War period. He was the father of the sixth president of the United States, John Quincy Adams, and he was the cousin of Samuel Adams, known as the father of the Revolution. John Adams' quote regarding the Ten Commandments was not isolated, and indeed it was indicative of the belief of the worldview of America's founder. After reviewing an estimated 15,000 items, including newspaper articles, pamphlets, books, monographs, that were written between 1760 and 1805 by the 55 men who wrote our Constitution, Professors Donald S. Lutz and Charles S. Henneman, in their work called The Relative Influence of European Writers on Late 18th Century American Political Thought, published in the American Political Science Review in 1984, revealed that the Bible, especially the Book of Deuteronomy, contributed 34% of all of the quotations used by our founding fathers. And I remember before I took the break, I said, the Ten Commandments in the Bible have a greater influence on and is quoted more often than any other document or any other personage in the history of the United States. You will find more of the Ten Commandments and the laws of the Scripture contained in our founding documents, contained in the writings of and espoused by our founding fathers, than you're going to find in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights or the Declaration of Independence or any other document. In fact, it gets better than that, or worse, depending upon your political or your religious views. The other main sources cited include Baron Charles Montesquieu, 8.3%, Sir William Blackstone, 7.9%, John Locke, 2.9%, David Hume, 2.7%, Plutarch, 1.5%, Baccaria, 1.5%, Trenchard and Gordon, 1.4%, Delomey, 1.4%, Samuel von Pufendorf, 1.3%, Cicero, 1.2%, Hugo Grotius, 0.9%, Shakespeare, 0.8%, Vattel, 0.5%. These additional sources as well took 60% of their quotes directly from the Bible. Direct and indirect citations combined revealed that the majority of all of the quotations referenced by the founding fathers were derived from the Bible. 60%. There isn't any other source of information contained in the legal system of America that even comes close. The highest percentage over here was from a Frenchman named Baron Charles Montesquieu. It was 8.3%. William Shakespeare had some influence on American jurisprudence. It was 0.8%. Now remember where this came from. In reviewing 15,000 items that were written by our founding fathers between 1760 and 1805 in a 45-year period by the 55 men who wrote our Constitution. So they went, these two professors went out here and took a look at 15,000 statements, articles, newspaper reports, and so on from these 55 men. Where did they get their information? Where did they get their ideas? Where did they get their beliefs and concepts in law? And they didn't get them from the ACLU or the NAACP or from Harvard University. In fact, they took the time to actually take a look at, well, where did these ideas come from? 60% of their quotes come directly from the Bible. They didn't come from Shakespeare. 0.8% came from Shakespeare. They were familiar with the works of Shakespeare. They were familiar with the works of Montesquieu. They knew about William Blackstone. In fact, William Blackstone comes in second. William Blackstone contained about 8%, 7.9%. So around 8% of their citations, quotations, beliefs, opinions, and concepts came from William Blackstone. William Blackstone was a very important jurist, a very important judge. And then he wrote Blackstone's commentaries. And our founding fathers, all 55 of them, knew about William Blackstone. In fact, he wrote his books in 1767, so he was a contemporary. And it would be like Justice William Rehnquist was a contemporary of those of us living today. And they took some of their ideas. 8% of their ideas came from him. 60% of their ideas came from the Bible. Now, that's very significant, boys and girls. When you have a source of information like the Bible, and you cite it and quote it and use it and wallow in it, you know, 60% of the time, that's the majority. So if you want to know where the majority of Anglo-Saxon administration comes from, here in the United States, in our secular government, in our laws, not recently. I mean, this doesn't come from Barbara Boxer now, or Dianne Feinstein, or Ted Kennedy. But when we're looking at people like George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, you know, our old-timey presidents in the past, you know, even recent presidents, you know, fairly recent, you know, guys like William McKinley and William Bradford, Thomas Hooker, William Penn, Roger Sherman, Samuel Adams, Governor Morris, Alexis de Tocqueville, Daniel Webster, William McGuffey, McGuffey's readers. You know, in the old days, they used to have a reader that they taught children to read from. William Holmes McGuffey, from 1800 to 1873, was an American educator. He was the president of Ohio University. He was a professor at the University of Virginia, the department chairman at the Miami University of Ohio. He was responsible for forming the first teachers' association in that part of the country. William McGuffey was considered the schoolmaster of the nation. McGuffey published the first edition of his McGuffey's Readers in 1836. This book was the mainstay in public education in America until 1920. McGuffey's Readers were the mainstay of American education from 1836 to 1920. And boys and girls, between 1836 and 1920, Johnny could read. Today, Johnny can't read, but he isn't being taught out of McGuffey's Readers either. So if you want your child to read, you go back and get a set of McGuffey's Readers. They're rare books now, and I think they've been reprinted, though. I think you can get them in your home school library, McGuffey's Readers. If you want your child to read, you put him on McGuffey's Readers, and he'll learn to read. As of 1963, 125 million copies had been sold, making it one of the most widely used and influential textbooks of all times. Millions of American children learned to read and write from it. In the foreword of McGuffey's Reader in 1836, William H. McGuffey wrote this. He said, "The Ten Commandments and the teachings of Jesus are not just basic, but plenary. The Christian religion is the religion of our country. From it are derived our prevalent notions of the character of God, the great moral governor of the universe. On its doctrines are founded the peculiarities of our free institutions." That's what William McGuffey thought of the Bible and of God and the Ten Commandments. Mark Twain, you know, old Mark Twain. Here's what he said. In a response to criticism of the authenticity of the Bible, Mark Twain said this. He said, quote, "If the Ten Commandments were not written by Moses, then they were written by another fellow by the same name." That's Mark Twain. If the Ten Commandments weren't written by Moses, then they were written by somebody else with the same name. William McKinley, Alfred E. Smith, Cecil B. DeMille, Herbert Hoover, Dwight D. Eisenhower, Harry S. Truman, Conrad Hilton, Ronald Reagan, Robert Byrd, Margaret Thatcher, and William Grabb, Fobb James, Governor of Alabama, U.S. Congress, the U.S. Supreme Court, the U.S. District Court. These are some of the people and institutions that have made comments concerning the Ten Commandments and the influence of the Ten Commandments on our history and on our legal system. Now, John Adams had more to say about the Ten Commandments and about religion and in American life. I'm not going to read it all to you. You can go read it for yourself. But let me hit a couple of three famous names in here before we have to call it a day. William Bradford. William Bradford lived from 1590 to 1657. He was a leader of the Plymouth Colony. Sailing in the Mayflower, he was chosen as governor of the colony in 1621. He was reelected 30 times until his death in 1657. In 1650, William Bradford wrote a history of the Plymouth Plantation, which is comparable to Shakespeare's works in literary and historical influence. In 1650, Governor William Bradford stated of Plymouth Plantation, he said, "Though I am grown aged, yet I have had a longing desire to see with my own eyes something of the most ancient language and holy tongue in which the law and oracles of God were writ, and in which God and angels spoke to the holy patriarchs of old time, and what names were given to things from the creation, and though I cannot attain to such herein, yet I am refreshed to have seen some glimpse hereof, as Moses saw the land of Canaan afar off. My name and desire is to see, or my aim, A-I-M-E, my aim and desire is to see how the words and phrases lie in the holy text, and to discern somewhat of the same from my own content. A little hard to read William Bradford in this old English here, but William Penn, from 1644 to 1718, was the founder of Pennsylvania. He was the son of a British Navy admiral by the same name, who discovered Bermuda and helped strengthen King Charles II's throne. William Penn attended Oxford University and later studied law. In 1667, at the age of 22, William Penn was impressed by the sermon delivered by Thomas Lowe entitled "The Sandy Foundation Shaken." He converted to the Christian beliefs of the Society of Friends, or Quakers, who at that time were scorned and ridiculed. Well, William Penn became a Quaker, preacher, and writer beginning in 1668, and he suffered imprisonment three times for his faith. Once he was imprisoned in the Tower of London for 8 months, during which time he wrote the classic book, No Cross, No Crown. The false notion that they may be children of God while in a state of disobedience to his holy commandments and disciples of Jesus, though they revolt from his cross and members of his true church, which is without spot or wrinkle, notwithstanding their lives are full of spots and wrinkles, is of all other deceptions upon themselves the most pernicious to their eternal condition, for they are at peace in sin and under a security in their transgression. End of quote. That was from William Penn, referring to the Ten Commandments. Roger Sherman made this statement. Roger Sherman was the fellow who was at the forefront of the move to include in Article 1, Section 10, the gold clause, the gold and silver clause. No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Where did he get that idea? It came from "Thou shalt not steal, and you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag." Two principles of law, one from the Ten Commandments and one from the Law of Moses, concerning gold and silver coin, just weights and balances. Roger Sherman was distinguished as the only founding father to sign all four major founding documents. And that was the Articles of Association in 1774, the Declaration of Independence in 1776, the Articles of Confederation in 1777, and the Constitution of the United States in 1787. Representative Roger Sherman wrote a letter from New York to Samuel Hopkins, the Congregational minister of Newport, Rhode Island. He said that a God of infinite goodness can, through atonement, have mercy on whom he will, consistent with the honor of his law and government and all of his perfections, is a much better ground of hope than the denial of self-love. So these men in our ancient or past history, we'll say ancient history because they're at the very beginning of the nation, in some cases like William Penn, predating by far our Constitution and founding documents, back in colonial times. These are men that believed in God and the Ten Commandments and practiced the law of God. Let me run through some of them again. I haven't got time to run through all of their statements, but Daniel Webster, you know, Webster's Dictionary. Remember that guy? William McGuffey. I gave you his quotation. He's the guy that wrote McGuffey's Readers. Alexis de Tocqueville. He was a French statesman, historian, and social philosopher. Cecil B. DeMille, the guy the movie mogul who put out the Ten Commandments. Alfred E. Smith. He was candidate for president in 1928. He was the Democratic nominee for president of the United States. Alfred E. Smith was a Catholic. And here's what he said. He said, "I'm unable to understand how anything I was taught to believe as a Catholic could possibly be in conflict with what is good citizenship. The essence of my faith is built upon the Ten Commandments, the commandments of God, the law of the land is built on the commandments of God, and there can be no conflict between them." That was Alfred E. Smith, presidential candidate in 1928. He was probably defeated because he was a Catholic. You know, so if you stop and think about it, you know, just because you're a Catholic, a Protestant, a Jew, you're a Muslim, or you're somebody else, the Ten Commandments is a code, it's a legal code given to us by our Creator. You can sit there and argue with that, but hell, everybody around the world believes in thou shalt not steal, and thou shalt do no murder, and thou shalt not commit adultery, for crying out loud. We just give credit to Allah, or we give credit to Moses, or we give credit to Jesus, or we give credit to some other God. Most people around the world subscribe to a code of conduct, some code of conduct. Here in the Western world, we got our code of conduct from what we call the Hebrew Scriptures, and we call it the Bible. Most of our names and appellations are incorrect. It's really called the Scripture in the Bible. It's called the Scripture, but you know, we go to Sunday school and church, and they teach us it's the Bible. But it's a code of conduct, and we practice that code of conduct here in the United States. And when we practice the Ten Commandment code, the Ten Commandment model, before we learned to practice the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto model, we became the wealthiest, most powerful nation in the world, politically, economically, and militarily. It's no longer true, but the Ten Commandment model was certainly superior to the Ten Plank model that we're following now. Hey, I'm out of time here, kids. We're going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Hey, time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.